You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Apple seems to have emerged from the death of co-founder Steve Jobs in 2011, saddened, but not all that weakened. Under CEO Tim Cook, the company continued to turn out new products like a significantly upgraded version of the iPad tablet, but it's also had to deal with patent lawsuits and has continued to face scrutiny over harsh conditions in its Chinese factories. Tech journalist Yukari Iwatani-Kane looks at the legacy of Apple in the Tim Cook era in her book, Haunted Empire, Apple After Steve Jobs. It's published by HarperCollins. I'm very pleased that it has brought Yukari Iwatani-Kane to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
Now, Apple is known for its cult of secrecy. So how did you manage to speak to so many current and former employees with intimate knowledge about the workings of the company?
Little by little. I had several sources, a core group of sources from the days when I was covering Wall Street Journal or covering Apple for the Wall Street Journal. And then went from there, you know, asking for introductions and getting introduced to one by one.
Had you spent much time with Steve Jobs when you were at the Journal?
You know, I started covering Apple at a really interesting time, right after Steve had lost all this weight and nobody knew what was going on. And when the world was waking up to the fact that Steve Jobs may not be around forever. And so the secrecy was just, you know, tripling down. And so I had a few encounters with him, but not as many as I might as well otherwise.
But you have devoted the first third of the book to the time he was in charge.
Yes.
Do you have any sense of how employees feel about the company now that he's gone?
I think there's definitely a sense of loss. And
the title suggests it's haunted.
It's, you know, not literally haunted, of course, but figuratively that there's a lot of, you know, what would Steve Jobs do? What would have happened differently if he was around? And, you know, it's internally, but it's also from the outside as well.
Well, it's understandable considering the fact that he was forced out of the company at one point and came back when it was just on the verge of bankruptcy. And now it is one of the most successful companies in the world.
Absolutely. And, you know, and it's not...
All through him?
All through...
I mean, I can't believe it was only Steve Jobs for that recovery.
No, I mean, it was a team effort. But I think that, you know, he was, you know, to use the 1984 commercials, I mean, he was the leader, the revolutionary leader, right? I mean, he was the one that brought them all together. And so, you know, he was such a big presence. His name was synonymous with Apple's, and you know, Apple's world revolved around him for a very long time.
And he was famous for his ability to motivate people to work crazy hours in pursuit of the best products. Has that drive for perfection continued under Tim Cook? Because he comes across as a kind of reserved, numbers-focused organizational type.
Oh yeah, I mean, I think that the drive, the desire is there. But the sense of crisis that Steve managed to inject in the company, even as it was pulling in, you know, double and triple digit growth some quarters, was pretty unique and singular. You know, Apple is so successful today that I think it's hard. I mean, you do get to a place where, you know, employees get tired. They sit back a little bit. They want to enjoy their success and wealth, and they also feel like they deserve to be on top. And that changes the dynamics.
And they also get hired away by
yes,
other companies
yes.
that want to have some of that Apple sensibility. Well, but on the other hand, Apple nearly doubled its earnings per share in 2011 compared to 2010. And management finally announced plans for the firm's first dividend since 1995. Doesn't Tim Cook deserve some of that credit?
I think that, you know, by normal accounts, I agree that Apple is still very successful. And the problem with that is that Apple itself holds itself to a higher standard of success to change the world with their insanely great products. And so I'm not saying that Apple is doomed or that it's going into this steep decline. But I am saying that by their standards of success that they've set forth, they're not cutting it.
Did you speak with Walter Isaacson when you were putting this book together?
I did.
What insights did he have about Apple as a company?
You know, he was so focused on the Steve Jobs eras that, you know, he just kept saying, you know, I can't wait to read your book. And your book, you know, I have all these questions and I'm hoping that your book will answer them.
Well, a lot is being made about the difference between Jobs and Cook and personality and his managers. What do you think is the biggest difference between them?
I think, you know, it's the big perception of Steve Jobs' reality distortion field and his ability to convince people that what Apple did was great and revolutionary and history-changing. And, you know, he had this ability to really convince people. And when mistakes were made, he managed to convince them that they weren't as big of a deal. And I think without him, Apple under Tim Cook is just simply less convincing.
Well, it has yet to have a game-changing device created since he took over, but it's only been a couple of years. And game-changing devices just don't come along. Do you think that one might be coming soon?
I think that they're certainly going to try. You know, Apple's model has always been that the problem with being so successful with their products is that everybody wants a piece of it. And so as its rivals, as Apple wannabes get into one market, they jump to the other and benefit from it for a couple of years. So they are at a point where they need to do that now.
But you suggest they're kind of resting on their laurels right now. Talking about all of their previous innovations. Isn't that what has caused problems for Microsoft, which once looked like it was going to put Apple out of business? Also, Nokia and BlackBerry seem to have lost their ways. Intel missed out on the smartphone chip development possibilities. Can misjudgments like that bring down a company as successful as Apple?
I think that these are all big company problems, that they're problems that every company faces when they achieve a certain scale and success in business. And Apple is facing those same challenges. And by the way, that Steve Jobs would have had to deal with this as well.
And are they feeling the competition from Samsung, Google, and others?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Because Samsung looked like a small player, and now it's it is a major challenger to Apple.
Yes, and you know what's interesting is that Apple's involved in this epic battle with Samsung over their patents, and from Samsung and Korea's perspective, I learned through my reporting that they're actually rejoicing because it validates them as a worthy rival, as a worthy opponent for Apple.
Do you think that the future for Apple is TV, which has often been discounted in the tech industry?
You know, I hear that they're looking into it and they're working on things out of Taiwan. But I used to cover the television industry for several years, and it's a really rough market. The margins that they're striving for is about 10%. You know, if they could get 10%, that would be great. And Apple's a company that wants 30-40% margins. So to me, the math doesn't add up.
My guest is Yukari Iwatani Kane. Her book, Haunted Empire, Apple After Steve Jobs. Well, what does the tech industry think of Tim Cook? Do they see him as the right man for the job?
You know, I guess I would quote Larry Ellison, who I think last summer said that, you know, we've done the experiment about what happens when Steve Jobs leaves. And so I think there is general skepticism. But, you know, but I also think that, you know, Tim Cook is facing, you know, perhaps an insurmountable job because, you know, nobody's going to be better at being Steve Jobs than Steve Jobs himself.
Well, how much of what happened at Apple was directly from Steve Jobs and how much of it was just simply from him encouraging people to come up with new ideas? I mean, Steve Jobs didn't wake up one morning and say, hey, how about a smartphone?
Right.
But although there already were smartphones on the market at that time.
Oh, absolutely. And I think you're right. I mean, he was just a great leader. I mean, people often compare him or describe him as an editor. you know, in a publication or something, but he was just good at saying, knowing what to say no to, what, how to get the best out of people, whether it was through, you know, a carrot or a stick, and you know, he had vision.
So does the right choice in a CEO depend on where a company wants to go?
Yeah, and where a company is in its business cycle. I mean, I actually don't think that Tim Cook is the wrong leader for Apple today. I mean, Steve Jobs left chaos in his wake. I mean, the way he wanted to run the business, like, you know, you can't run a big company like a startup, which is how he really tried to do.
And he depended on Tim Cook to keep things running smoothly.
Right.
And despite, I think, what he was doing.
Yeah. And the organization was, you know, was fraying at the edges. And so I think Tim Cook is a great leader to fix all of that. But then you are talking about a different company, and the company's line that Apple's the same doesn't resonate anymore.
Well, because he is the kind of guy we usually associate with being the head of a company of this size.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was able to keep all of the Apple executive team intact in the wake of Steve Jobs' death. And that had to be really significant.
I think that's, yeah. I mean, I definitely give him credit for that. I think he was very smart to do that.
Well, what was Johnny Ive's role at Apple when Jobs was there, and how did that change when Cook took over?
They had a very close relationship, from what I understand. Steve loved to spend time with Johnny in his studio, and they had lunches together. He was there.
He's
half
the man
the
who
time.
Gave the Apple products their look.
Yeah, and I do think that Tim Cook is leaning on Johnny now to step in to provide that vision. I think, you know, the challenge with that is that Johnny doesn't have the moral authority that Steve had to convince people that his vision is the right vision. And so, you know, I'm skeptical of how much the troops are going to lead in his steps.
Well, so much of Apple's success, at least as I see it, is based on the way these things look. And when you see a movie and somebody opens up a laptop and it has that Apple logo go on, actually, mm-hmm. You've already sold another product to somebody. the smartphone looked better than all of the other, the iPhone looks better than all the other smartphones when it came out. Now there are new ones that may be looking just as good, but they were spurred on by what Johnny Ives was doing.
Yeah, I mean, I heard a funny story about the reaction that the industrial design team had when they saw HTC's One Phone, I think it was called, and how they had just realized that they kind of had sat back and for a year just satisfied with an incremental improvement when their rival was doing something really interesting from a design perspective, and they felt like, you know, they needed to catch up again.
And have they?
I've heard that they have buckled down since and they're working hard again. But, you know, part of the problem is that they've done too good a job so far. The iPhones are good enough. And I'm not sure that incremental improvements in beauty is something that people are willing to pay money for.
Well, right now the iPhone is still the phone of choice, with the Android a close second, isn't it? Or some
in
parts
the U.S.
of the world.
Yeah.
In the rest of the world, Android is number one?
I think... you know, it depends on the measurements. You know, Apple will say that, you know, based on usage or based on revenues, that it comes out differently. But, you know, I certainly hear that in Asia and Europe, Android phones and particularly Samsung's phones are gaining and sometimes even exceeding.
My guest is Yukari Iwatani-Kane, who's a veteran journalist with nearly 15 years of experience writing about the tech industry. She was at the Wall Street Journal for quite a while, covering Apple during the last years of Steve Jobs' reign. And now she's written a book called Haunted Empire, Apple After Steve Jobs. It is published by Harper Business. Stay with us for more. We're back with Yukari Iwatani-Kane. Her book, Haunted Empire, Apple After Steve Jobs, published by Harper Business. Can you explain the Foxconn-Apple relationship, how it flourished and why it began to falter?
Well, Foxconn was really got involved around the time that Steve Jobs came back. If you remember back when in the late 1990s, Apple was still making a lot of its products in the U.S. As well as Singapore. But it became clear that manufacturing needed to be outsourced, which was an industry trend, but also Apple was doing so poorly that they couldn't afford to keep their factories anymore. And so that's where Foxconn came in, and they've really been with Apple since the ground up, and I think Apple contributed a huge amount to its success.
Well, but there's been plenty of negative press on the hazardous conditions at the Foxconn plant and the treatment of workers. What effect has that had on Apple's bottom line?
In terms of bottom line, I think it's hard to say. But in terms of public perception, I think it's been hurtful because it's part of the narrative that Steve Jobs never wanted to talk about, and now it's been exposed.
Well, Steve Jobs wanted the same kind of thing that Google wanted, to do no harm or whatever the line is, and then Apple had to deal with reports of suicides at the Foxconn mm-hmm. plant. Did they handle it well?
I think they handled it as well as they could. And part of the point that I wanted to make in my telling of it in the book is that a lot of it is out of Apple's control, but they're still going to be hurt by it because they have such a big presence there.
Out of Apple's control because Foxconn has a lot of leverage of its own?
Because of that, because of the fact that it's in China and sometimes the public perception here of how things are what's happening over there are different because the workers' expectations are different because of so many things, and they're all risks to Apple, regardless of whether they're at fault or not.
Well, you include a chapter about Aichi, a worker at the Foxconn plant. Mm-hmm. What was the purpose of telling her story?
I wanted to show how complex the issues were in China. And, for example, Apple and Foxconn were both criticized for the long hours and the bad pay. And so what they did was they cut overtime and they increased wages. Well, from, the factory workers' perspective, they're there to work and earn as much money as possible because that's the best way to get out of their stations in life. And so for them, time is a luxury. Money is more of what they want. And so there was a lot of frustration and anger about how that was dealt with. People weren't I heard very little sentiment in praise of Apple or thankful to Apple. So they
prefer to be worked incredibly long hours?
There's excessive hours, and then there's just dangerously excessive hours. But they want to work for as much money as possible, and they do want overtime. I mean, I think they don't want to be worked to death, but. And so it's a really complicated issue that Apple has to respond to the Western perception about, but is difficult to deal with on the ground.
But when people commit suicide, it suggests that there are serious problems.
There are problems, but then you also have to keep in mind that I think the tally that I heard was at the most there are maybe two dozen suicides in a campus with hundreds of thousands of workers. I mean, the suicide rate, if you think about it in that context, is lower than in the U.S., lower than a lot of countries. And so when you have that many people, you will have suicides. Now, that's not to say that the reasons aren't legitimate and should be fixed.
The New York Times won a Pulitzer for their iEconomy series examining Apple's attempts to skirt paying taxes in the United States. Apple's a pretty successful company. Can you discuss what their reporting found and what's been happening in Ireland, where there has been some political trouble, and also in the Senate, where Carl Levin's permanent subcommittee on investigations has been looking into this?
Well, Apple makes a lot of money overseas. They sell lots of iPhones and iPads and Macs overseas, and so there's all this cash overseas, and the U.S. taxes companies at a really high rate on money that's brought back in from the outside. And so Apple has kept all this money outside. And so you know, from the government's perspective, there's all this potential tax income that Apple's not paying, and that's been the issue.
Well, Apple is an American company, mm-hmm. and it makes a lot of money. What would be so terrible if they paid more taxes?
I agree.
But they still see this as, well, and now in Ireland, there are people who are concerned because they've pretty much created a tax haven for companies like
right.
Apple. And they're wondering why they're not getting a piece of the action.
Yeah, and I do think that it, you know, other people have talked about this in the past as well, but it, you know, reflects a little bit of the times that that companies and people feel like if they're doing fine, then that's okay, and other people fend for themselves.
Well, is part of the problem that Apple likes to give the impression of being very responsible as a corporation, and then we hear about these other things?
Definitely. And I think that, you know, one of the things that this book tries to do is to point out the difference between the public's perception that Steve Jobs had successfully created, that Apple's this benign company that's trying to do good for the world and change the world. But it's become this massive company with the same interests as any other massive company.
My guest is Yukari Iwatani-Kane. Her book, Haunted Empire, Apple After Steve Jobs. It's published by Harper Business. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, talking about doing good for the world, can we talk about Siri for a moment?
Sure.
Is that the first failure of the Tim Cook era?
It probably would be considered that way. And I actually don't blame the faulty technology on Tim Cook, because he had just taken over. But what I do...
This is really Steve Jobs' baby.
Yeah, and it's the kind of technology that would have taken a really long time to get polished and developed. So it's a problem with expectations. And what I do find questionable is, you know, Apple called Siri a beta product, and yet it made it the centerpiece of ads to sell its, I think it was the iPhone 4S. And so, like, the idea that Steve Jobs would have put a feature that doesn't work that well as the centerpiece of ads to sell an iPhone is mystifying to me.
Well, it was pointed out that one of the problems was that Siri couldn't go to Google because Google was seen as a major competitor. And so some of the information she got wasn't the best information.
Well, there was and I think there were other sources that Siri stopped being able to draw from initially. They've added since, but the way the technology works is that it has to draw from different parts of the internet to get the right information. So if it's only accessing, you know, 5 or 6 sites, then they only get information for those sites. And the original Siri accessed a lot of sites.
And then the Apple Maps fiasco was probably even worse than Siri. And it wound up prompting an apology from Tim Cook. Why did that go so wrong? I mean, there are very good Google. Well, again, is it because Google would have been the alternative and Apple will not do anything with Google?
You know, I think there were a couple of reasons. You know, Google Maps used to be the default maps in the iPhone. And from what I do understand, there were contract issues and Google wasn't willing to give up certain features for Apple. And so they ended the contract and came up with their own version. Now, what I've heard from sources who are in the mapping business say that the technology itself is not that hard, but maybe Apple tried to do a little bit too much and crammed it all into an app. And then, you know, they focused on the visuals rather than the actual way it worked.
Have they corrected it by now?
It's improved. They're working on it. But, you know, they lost a ton of people over to the Google Maps site or app.
Mm-hmm. And then there is the whole business of e-publishing price fixing that Apple has been involved in. It hasn't made many friends in the publishing world.
Well, the initial act that they were accused of probably did make them friends in the publishing world because it helped them. But, you know, the thing that was interesting about that was that, you know, the judge in her ruling called Apple out on saying that that their testimony, their executives' testimonies, were untrustworthy, and that was really interesting because, you know, the year before I was sitting in the patent trials and Apple's executives went up and everybody was mesmerized. So I felt like that was a change in perception and temperature and feelings toward Apple.
Well, can you talk about the Apple-Samsung lawsuits? What's at the heart of them?
I think, I'm still trying to make sense of it to a certain extent because I don't see how the outcome it will affect the market or Apple's business itself. People have told me that Steve Jobs really wanted to paint Samsung as a copyist, that he was emotionally angry about it. Samsung, as I may have mentioned before, you know, is just it feels like Apple has validated them as a worthy opponent. And so I just, you know, from a market perspective, I don't know if any consumer is going to buy the iPhone over the Galaxy because the Galaxy is a copy.
But is there a blurred line when it comes to patents in this area? Google also gets involved in this, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, Samsung is, well, I don't know if it's true at this point, but I think in the beginning, Samsung and others were a proxy for attacking Android. At this point, I mean, Android has something like over 80% market share. I mean, the ship has sailed on this, and innovation is always built on top of somebody else's technology. So it's, I don't see what the point of it is.
Well, the lawsuits continue. In January, Judge Lucy Koh ruled against Samsung. Who, in your estimation, has come out ahead in all of this legal bantering?
You know, I think the thing about patent battles is that they're drawn out, and I'm not sure anybody has come out ahead. I mean, Apple got a nice bump in the beginning for having won the trial, but I'm not sure it's been reflected in their market share.
Their smartphone market share recently dipped below 18%, while Samsung's has risen to 30%. How do we evaluate that kind of measurement?
I think it's a dangerous sign for Apple. You know, it's Tim Cook's line is usually that, you know, well, people use iPhones more than they use Android phones, and that they don't care about market share. They're about building the best phone there is. And I think that's a great message when you're doing well. But when you're on your way down, you know, it sounds like you're not being realistic. I mean, if you were building the best phones, then it would be selling.
But I guess you said on your way down, isn't it almost inevitable that someone who is the king of the hill will eventually lose a little bit?
Oh,
I remember MySpace. Mm-hmm. What happened to MySpace? Is it still around?
No, absolutely. And one of my main points is that Apple is, you know, all of these things that are happening to Apple would have happened under Steve Jobs anyway. You know, they're big company problems. You know, companies with a large amount of market share will eventually start losing market share. The fact that Steve Jobs is no longer around to help public perception along, to make things easier for the company, it makes the job a lot harder.
We've often heard in the media about what it's like to work on the Google campus. Does working at Apple have a similar setup for its engineers?
Working at Apple, from what I understand, is miserable. I think about one engineer who told me this story about where he compared himself to Sisyphus, the god that would roll up the boulder up the hill and then only to see it roll down again. And that's what it was like at Apple, because, you know, you're required to work these tremendous amount of hours without knowing what the whole picture is because of the secrecy.
So there's management pressure, but you're not sure what you're being pressured to do?
Exactly. And what made it worthwhile in the past is that Steve Jobs would announce it, you know, and it would be this amazing thing. People would react to it. It would sell, and you feel like you helped change history. And that is not there as much anymore. And that really resounded with me.
Harvard Business Professor Clayton Christensen has spent years looking at what makes big companies successful. Can you explain his basic theory and how Apple fits into that?
Well, what what Clay Christensen says is that, you know, eventually a disruptor will grow so big and will end up with a market that's so attractive that all these rivals come in and they start out with, you know, perhaps with inferior products, but that capture something that the consumers want. And the dominant company tends to ignore that because it's such a small market, but they slowly encroach and grow to take up that market.
Now, Tim Cook has been highly critical of the book. There are people who might claim that it comes off as anti-Apple. Mm-hmm. How do you respond?
You know, I'm a journalist. I'm not anti-Apple. I'm a pro-Apple. I did write my book on a Mac Air.
And you have a smartphone.
And and I do, you know, emphasize that this is what I've seen over the last few years, and I'm not trying to predict anything. I mean, I think that the story continues, but you know, in terms of Tim Cook's comment, it reminds me of the good old days because, you know, every time I broke a story, Steve Jobs or Apple would tell me that it's not true or tell somebody else that it's not true, and they would end up being true.
Yukari Iwatani Kane's book is Haunted Empire, Apple After Steve Jobs. It is published by Harper Business. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.